We're at a point where the turnover of the existing homes is at a quite low level at the moment. So, you know, that kind of the housing cycle needs to work efficiently to ensure that the housing stock is used productively. So we need to ensure that that cycle is working effectively and taxes and stamp duty and other government charges are not inhibiting that cycle from working effectively.
You're listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent, for real estate industry sales professionals, property managers, and leaders. With thanks to our partner, Connect Now, Elevate brings you the best tools, thinking, and strategies to elevate your results. For more information about how Connect Now can make moving easier for your clients, visit connectnow.com.au. And to get new episodes of Elevate directly to your inbox, sign up at eliteagent.com/subscribe. Here is your host, Kylie Dulhunty.
Hey everyone, it's Kylie Dulhunty here. Today's guest is the head of research at Al J. Hooker, bringing over two decades of research in real estate market analysis and strategy. He's renowned for his sharp insights and data-driven approach and has become a trusted voice in the industry, helping agents and investors navigate an ever-changing property landscape. His extensive research and commentary are regularly featured in top-tier media, making him a go-to expert for understanding market trends and forecasts. Matthew Tiller, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kylie. It's great to be here.
Fantastic. It's good to have you. I was actually doing a little bit of research just before we jumped online this morning. I was LinkedIn stalking you. And one thing that I didn't know about you, and maybe some others listening don't as well, you actually started as a sales manager for Century 21 in Dubai, of all places. So tell me about that.
Yeah, that's where I kicked off my real estate career and my passion, I suppose, for real estate. Very interesting place in the world to be at that time in the early 2000s, particularly because there was nothing built there, really. There was an established housing market there, but that was for all the locals. And for those expats and foreigners wanted to buy in the country, it was just sand and plans on a page that was selling. So it was a really interesting time just to see the amount of construction going on there, but also just the level of demand for off the plan housing. If a project got announced and released, there was a kilometer line down the road from the sales shop to get sold, and it would be sold out within a day. Projects of thousands of units would be sold out within a day. So really, really great place to start. And it was a really interesting time in my career.
Yeah, amazing. How did you then go from Dubai to Australia?
Yeah, well, I'm from Australia. So just moved back after that experience. I was there for 3 years. And that was probably long enough in the fast paced market that was Dubai real estate at that time. It was a good experience and just wanted to come back home, obviously, to start a family and get in the real estate market here. So rather than going back into sales, I started with the great Tim Lawless, and he showed me the ropes for the research. So the research world, I suppose.
Yeah, not a bad mentor to have in Tim, is it?
Absolutely.
And so look, you are known as one of the people that the industry turns to for, I guess, making sense of the myriad of numbers that are out there. And what do you try and do with that? How do you simplify it and that type of thing to make it understandable for everyone?
Yeah, I think obviously it starts with the research, and that includes a lot of reading, but obviously also the extensive network that Al J. Hooker has, speaking to agents on the ground, because I find that obviously agents on the ground know what's going on in different pockets of the market. And that's where the real trends come from. It's from speaking with agents that have their fingers on the pulse and then just bubbling that up to a more macro level and just seeing what those trends are right across the country. I think that's the only way to get a detailed understanding of what's going on in the market.
Yeah. And one of the main things I wanted to chat to you about is the housing crisis, because of course there's a lot of headlines about it. But I guess I wanted to start with is, how did we get to this point there's a shortage of properties to buy, a shortage of properties to rent, prices, both rentals and purchasing, going up, and, you know, a real lack of supply. So how did we get here?
Yeah, and this is where I like to really go back to basics, particularly economics 101, and just look at that demand-supply imbalance. Because really, in the economy, no matter what industry you're in, if demand outstrips supply, then prices go up. That's the way of the world. So it's nothing different from that in real estate. So long and the short of it is we have demand outstripping supply. And this rings true for both the rental market and the sales market as well. So if we look at demand, yeah, it's not all about overseas migration, which is obviously the hot topic of the moment. I mean, yes, we have had population growth from international students returning after COVID, but skilled migrants coming in. We've got families and relatives of residents coming in as well. But we've also had, you know, population migration, so a shift in migration patterns after COVID from capital city to capital city, Melbourne to Brisbane. We've seen regional migration as well from capital city to places like Albury or the Central Coast, Newcastle from Sydney, or from Brisbane to Sunshine Coast, Gold Coast. So that kind of migrational shift has also put strains, high demand for some of those kind of smaller housing markets where it's really tricky to lift housing supply quickly. And also household sizes have shrunk as well. So even before COVID, we saw people wanting more space, young adults moving out of home. We saw divorce rates go up a little bit after COVID there as well. So splitting of households. So we had more people needing more homes. But at that same time, we also didn't have the level of supply coming through to house this increase in population and this decrease in household size. So that was the disconnect there. We just didn't have the construction capability to deliver the homes where they were needed across the country.
Yeah. And is that a matter of we need more tradespeople? Is it a matter of, I know there were issues during COVID with the supply chain, or is it also about, I guess, government stumping up some more money and to try and also get those approval processes right down at local government level faster?
It's probably all of those, but also ensuring, you know, if we're just going to talk about demand and population at the moment, it's also ensuring that when population growth does come in, it's going to places where it's needed. So there's no use increasing the construction workforce if it's just going to construct homes in Sydney or capital cities across the country. They need to be incentivized to ensure that supply is being lifted in regional and rural markets as well, because that's also having a big impact on rents and affordability within some of those smaller markets. It's also infrastructure spending as well. So governments have obviously spent a lot over the recent few years since COVID and even prior to COVID on delivering infrastructure. So hospitals, roads, airports, those kind of large ticket items have also taken construction workers away from residential construction as well, purely because obviously the longer form nature of those infrastructure projects, it's more secure work for workers. So they tend to migrate towards some of those bigger ticket items, and that's reduced the capacity of the residential construction industry.
Yeah, it's very circular, isn't it? Because obviously there's a big headline, you mentioned it before, about migration and people from overseas coming in. And, you know, we need the properties to house them, but also we need them because we do have a bit of a shortage of tradies.
Yeah, we absolutely do. And we, I mean, this budget, I know we'll get into it, but tried to address that as well. So obviously increase the apprenticeships, fee-free TAFE courses for those looking to get into the industry, which is good. But it's sort of a medium to long-term solution to ensure that those school leavers are getting the exposure to go into the construction industry, educate them that university is not always the only way. Getting into trades and getting into construction is also an education piece that governments need to provide to school leavers as well. So there is a little bit of a package in the current budget for that, but that only helps over the medium to long term. Really, the only way to increase the construction industry capacity in the short term is skilled migration or construction workers off large ticket infrastructure projects and bringing them back over into the residential construction industry. So that's the short-term approach to increase in supply, is increase the capacity of the industry in the short term.
Yeah, it's a bit of rob Peter to pay Paul, isn't it?
Absolutely, because we do need those infrastructure projects as well, particularly to decrease bottlenecks from supply chain bottlenecks that we have seen over COVID, ensuring transport is flowing to assist the logistics and warehousing industry, but also, you know, hospitals, schools, those kind of services are desperately needed as well, particularly for some of those new greenfield areas, which are obviously most popular because of the affordability of those.
Yeah, definitely. And now, you did just mention the budget, and I did want to talk to you about that. So first off, your immediate reaction, you're sitting there listening, and there was a few leaks prior to Jim's big speech, but what was your, I guess, your immediate reaction when you heard the greater detail?
Yeah, I mean, there is a good amount of funding in there for new housing measures, which is always good to see. Obviously, they got leaked beforehand, like you say. So there was no real additional surprises in there from a housing perspective. If we just look at those measures, if you like, we had a $9.3 billion new five-year agreement on social housing and homelessness with the federal government and the states. That's to combat homelessness and provide crisis support. There's also $1 billion directed towards crisis and transitional accommodation for women and children fleeing domestic violence, which obviously is urgently needed. We had $1 billion to get homes built sooner. So that's funding for states and territories to build local infrastructure, the roads, the sewers, the energy and the water for some of those fast-growing new greenfields areas. There's a $1.9 billion in concessional loans for community housing providers and a 10% increase in Commonwealth rental assistance. So my initial thoughts there are that there's plenty of funding. I mean, can always do with more funding, obviously, but there is a lot of funding in the budget to get homes built. What we've just discussed is probably sort of what's lacking. And it's a little bit about the detail about how the housing's going to get built. So the majority of those packages obviously pushes the onus from the federal government down onto the state and territory governments to get these housing built. And the federal government does have to take responsibility here as well, but definitely see how that funding transitions from the federal level to the state level, down into the local level, and how and where is this funding going to impact supply on the ground? Because that's the missing part at the moment. It's obviously great headline numbers, but how is the housing going to be delivered?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, because I note that just a few months ago, Chris Minns, Premier of New South Wales, came out and was saying, I don't think we're going to meet our quota. So I wonder if this little bit of extra funding and this new agreement, is there going to be a change in actually getting the walls up?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, if we have a look back to last year, 2023, we had 172,000 dwelling completions. And to reach the federal government's 1.2 million home goal over 5 years to 2029, we need about 250,000. So we were well short last year. We're going to be well short this year again. So we've got a couple of years to make up as well. So it really needs to be sped up, the amount of homes that are being built. And like we've just discussed about workforce shortages, the how and the where is still lacking in that detail as well.
Yeah, I agree completely. And before the budget, you did put together your wish list, as you do usually every year. And while they may not have come to fruition, there's still really good ideas in there, and some that I haven't seen a lot of other people mentioning. And I really wanted to, I guess, quiz you on the defence housing model idea that you have. So just explain to listeners what that is and how you would see that working.
Yeah, this is just an idea which Obviously, when you're in the middle of a crisis, you need to throw all the ideas out there and see if any of them do make sense and can come to fruition. So I was looking at the Defence Housing Australia, or DHA, models. So what I'm thinking here is that the housing could be provided to essential workers or low-income earners, you know, even a social or crisis accommodation, by adopting the same model used by DHA. So this was a scheme introduced in 1998 by the federal government, and it provides secure and quality controlled homes for defence members and their families. So basically it houses our defence force around Australia. Now, in the latest report, annual report, it says that the DHA have 16,000 properties under management, and 70% of the homes that they manage are owned by private investors, so mum and dad investors. So basically what they do is they try to attract private investors, the homes that they own, and bring them into their model where they then rent them out. They provide the rent to the private investor. So the private investor is basically guaranteed their rent by the federal government or the Defence Department, and the Defence Department then manage them for their staff. The other good thing is their long-term secure leases. So DHA leases the properties for generally 3, 6, 9, or 12 years. So both, again, if you're an investor, you have a good long-term contract in place, but also for a tenant, it provides security that they're looking for as well. So particularly some of these key workers in rural and remote locations. So we may need nurses, we may need teachers, we may need doctors in some of these regional and remote locations. So the government could potentially have a model like this set up for them, where they provide housing that comes from the existing stock, comes from the private investors within that market, and they can provide a long-term secure lease on those properties. And again, they can reduce in the overheads of bringing it into their department. They can have local real estate agencies manage the properties locally for them as well. So it's just the government getting into the management or the leasing of the existing homes that are in the market at the moment.
And I guess that would sort of help with that need for more homes immediately, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be about building them in 2, 4, 5 years' time. It would be purchasing existing stock and could provide houses relatively quickly.
Well, that's correct. I mean, the investors are already in some of those markets. It's just the government becomes a tenant that they're looking for. But also, I mean, the DHA also build their own accommodation as well. So they do construct homes in locations where they need housing. So again, there's a model already there set up by the government for defence. If we're talking rental crisis for essential workers or low-income workers, there's a model here that they've used in the past. It might be worth them having a look at that again.
And the other one that I found really interesting was we often hear about downsizing, encouraging the people that are in, that are perhaps older in life, that have a big home that the kids have all left, to sell that. But obviously there's often costs with stamp duty and things like that. But you were talking about also lowering the age for their contribution to superannuation. So tell me about that idea.
Yeah, so obviously another focus. So the budget and all conversation generally is around the supply of new homes into the market. And I think what often gets overlooked is ensuring that the existing stock that we have around Australia is used most productively. So we're talking productively, having it right size. So ensuring that someone that wants to downsize, someone an older retiree living in a house, wants to downsize and retire into a one-bedroom apartment, then they can do that at a reasonable cost. What we know is transactional costs for buying a home are way too high, really driven by stamp duty is the biggest inhibitor to people moving. Obviously, that's a state government thing, so not going to be mentioned in the federal budget, but potentially federal governments can work with state governments to help wean state governments off the stamp duty money that they're currently hooked on, provide stamp duty rebates as well. You know, that might be another thing. But for downsizers in particular, we obviously know that the primary residence is not in the asset pension asset test. But when they do sell a home, those sales proceeds can go towards obviously that pension asset test. So it needs to ensure that making the home sale proceeds are exempt from the pension asset test to ensure that retirees can downsize and their pension is not affected, but also make the sales proceeds contributions to superannuation tax-free from a lower age. So last year's budget, they reduced it from, I think, 60 to 65. That can be lowered further to down to 53 or 50 to ensure that the turnover of those larger homes happens, but also people can right-size, downsize into more appropriate accommodation to suit their needs.
Yeah, definitely. Instead of one person or two people sitting there with four bedrooms that don't get used, let's try and move them, well, not move them on, but have them take up a two-bedroom apartment in the city or something, and the family can move into the bigger home.
That's right. Obviously, we're at a point where the turnover of the existing homes is at a quite low level at the moment. So, you know, that kind of the housing cycle needs to work efficiently to ensure that the housing stock is used productively. So, you know, the housing cycle, first home buyer purchases a small studio apartment, then they become a young couple or they want to upsize into a townhouse, and then they have a family, they want to move into a house, and they want to downsize back down into apartments and townhouses as well. And the cycle starts again. So we need to ensure that that cycle is working effectively as well. And taxes and stamp duty and other government charges are not inhibiting that cycle from working effectively.
And we mentioned people that are sort of retiring. And another of your ideas, and when I read this, it reminded me of my grandfather. My uncle built a granny flat on the back of his block. It was a huge block, enough space for a one-bedroom granny flat, kitchen, lounge, bathroom, and a veggie garden out the back. That was very important for my grandfather. But he moved in there. And another of your ideas is to incentivize people to build that secondary dwelling. So just explain that idea for me.
Yeah, well, this, I suppose, comes off the back of the success that home builder package had during COVID. We saw there was great uptake of that program. So this one really is to, again, it's a way to increase housing supply, but also use the existing homes and land that we have more effectively as well. So this is to increase housing supply in the established low density suburbs and regional areas. So the federal government could introduce a secondary home incentive program where homeowners would be eligible for grants or incentives to construct secondary dwellings such as granny flats or backyard homes on their properties. This would encourage the development of these type of homes within those kind of lower density suburbs, and the ability for these homes to then be rented out to the private rental market. Like you say, homeowners could downsize into them as well and then rent out their house. So what we're trying to do here is increase the rental stock as opposed to increasing the new sales stock, increase rental stock, particularly in some of those lower density suburbs.
Yeah, I think there's no one solution that's going to work immediately. I think this has got to be a long-term issue. And I don't know what your opinion is, but I tend to think the governments have to, or, you know, the federal government, it's an election next year, but they need to look beyond the election and I guess try and come up with a more all-encompassing and longer term picture than just what the next 12 months is going to bring. What do you think?
I just think it's imperative that governments work together to solve the crisis that we have. So federal governments need to work with state governments and local governments as well, because all governments, all housing providers, all private investors, all households, we're all participants within the housing market in Australia. And there's no one-size-fits-all approach. each suburb, each region, each city is different in their needs for housing and where they are in the economic cycle as well. So it all needs to be an all-encompassing approach by all levels of government to help solve both the sales crisis and some of those affordability crises that we're having in the moment in some regions.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, sort of just touching on the rental market there, what are your thoughts on the situation in Victoria and also investors? Because whether it's state or federal, the majority of our rental properties are provided by private investors. And I do know quite a few in Victoria that are really sort of getting a bit cranky, to be honest. And they're thinking, oh, is this a good idea for us anymore? Maybe we'll sell. Is the LJ Hooker agents, property managers, are you guys seeing a lot of that happening?
Yeah, obviously there's been a few issues with the changes in Victoria in particular, and we are starting to see that through our network. But I think one of the things that governments forget at the moment, whether they're rent freezes or increased taxes on investors, is that private mum and dad investors dominate or provide the majority of rental housing stock in this country. And at the same time, all levels of government have reduced their commitment and spending on building social and affordable homes in the country. So while private investors have stepped up, governments have stepped down. And so until that changes, until the government invests more into housing and providing the needed rental accommodation that those vulnerable households need, then it's up to private investors, the private market, to make up the shortfall and come to the party and provide the accommodation that's needed. So if they tax investors out of the market, then there's going to be a hole. It's not going to solve the crisis unless governments step up to the plate. So it's a bit of a silly notion at the moment, I think, for governments to be doing that without the necessary investment back into the market.
Well, we've got a couple of good ideas for them that you've just mentioned. Let's hope they're listening. Might send the podcast link to them and see how we go. Before I let you go, I need to have a chat to you about the market and see what you think's happening on the ground at the moment, what the LJ Hooker Group agents are seeing. So it seems like sentiment's reasonable at the moment and prices are still going up much more slowly than last year. But what are you guys noticing?
Yeah, we're definitely still seeing good turnouts at open homes and auctions. There's definitely still demand in the market at the moment right across the country. We're also seeing a good uptick in appraisal activity as well. So we're seeing homeowners that have read about the strong price growth and seeing good sales results in their area are contacting agents to get their home approved and see what, appraised, and to see what the value of their home is in the current market. So that's a good indicator that we are in for a good listing season over winter and coming into spring. So there is a lot of activity at the moment, although some markets are a little bit more tight than the others. Western Australia in particular is very tight from a listing point of view. So our agents competing a little bit over there, still not seeing the appraisal numbers come through over there yet, but they are starting to increase on where they were this time last year. Whereas places like Victoria, we are seeing those listing numbers come through. And obviously the higher listing numbers has led to lower price growth in that state, but it's good activity for our agents on the ground, getting those listing numbers through. So it's a bit of a diverse market at the moment right across the country. It's hard to say one thing's happening right across the country. Price growth is still occurring everywhere. Demand still is in place and appraisals are starting to tick up. So it's really good activity for right across our network and hopefully for everyone else out there.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you mentioned that there's no one-size-fits-all all across the market because Adelaide's still getting really great price growth and so is Perth, obviously, because those listings are a bit lower. But what's the trend with South Australia and Western Australia at the moment?
Again, it's a kind of supply-demand imbalance. definitely not enough supply and those markets have come through over the recent years. They have also seen a strengthening of the economic conditions in both those markets, which has led to stronger sort of migration, if you like, from eastern states over there. So population growth has increased into both those states, but definitely still that the contribution there from new housing has not met demand. So yeah, we're still seeing the prices very strong in those two markets and still will continue over the short term, at least, because there's no level of new supply coming into the market that's going to dampen the prices or rental growth for that matter as well. And also affordability as well, getting into that basket as well. Affordability of both Perth and Adelaide compared to Sydney, Melbourne in particular is quite good. And obviously Perth has just come off a downturn as well, so which has obviously made that market more affordable than where it was prior to COVID.
Yeah, you definitely do get a lot more for your dollar.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to also check, and it's kind of budget related, but about interest rates. And the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, did sort of make the comment, I mean, he stressed the word could, but he did say we could get back into the RBA's target range of 2 to 3% this year. Do you think that's likely, I guess, or what are your views on what interest rates might do for the rest of the year?
Yeah, so prior to budget, in the RBA had forecast inflation returning to its 2 to 3% band next year, 2025. So it was sort of already going to happen. What the expectation really is from the Treasurer is that the $300 energy rebate and the increase in Commonwealth's rental assistance will take about half a percentage point off headline inflation numbers. So because those two things, energy and rent, have been a large contributor to the elevated inflation numbers over the last couple of years. So that's what he's hoping. Now, the expectation is that that will happen. It will take some degree of relief off the CPI number. But at the same time, both of those measures combined with the stage three tax cuts, just going to put a bit more money back into households' pockets as well as businesses as well with things like the instant asset write-off. So there's going to be a little bit more spending coming into the economy than there is saving. So I think potentially it will be a little bit neutral in terms of spending and savings measures. So I think we are on the same path as where we were before the budget. So expecting inflation to return back to the target next year, 2025, with the most likely course being first rate cut coming at the start of 2025 as opposed to at the end of 2024.
Well, only time will tell, but you are part of our panel of experts every cash rate decision day, so we'll check how right you are. Won't hold it against you if you're wrong. Yeah.
It's the biggest question on everyone's lips at the moment, tracking the cash rate.
Yeah, definitely. And look, just for all the agents out there listening, thinking, what should I be doing right now to get some traction in the market, I guess, immediately? And obviously, it's always about the lead up to spring. What do you think they need to be doing to, I guess, try and get that pipeline bubbling along?
Yeah, I think one of the positive things, as I've said, is that there's price growth happening right across the country. So no matter what region or capital city you're in, there is good news in the market at the moment for homeowners. And like I said, the LGA Hooker Network is definitely seeing appraisal numbers pick up. So it's definitely a time to be out there spruiking those recent price growth we have and getting into living rooms to sell that to homeowners.
Yeah, amazing. Fingers crossed everyone is going to be having a good winter and also an even better spring. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. And if there's, I guess, one little tidbit or takeaway you'd like everyone to, I guess, take away about what we need to do on the housing crisis, what would the main message be, do you think?
Build, build, build.
Yes, I agree. Look, Matthew, thank you so much. Nice to catch up with you, and I'm sure we'll speak again soon.
Great. Thanks for having me, Carly.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Elevate Podcast, with thanks to Connect Now. To stay in touch with all things Elite Agent, sign up for our daily newsletter, The Brief, at eliteagent.com/subscribe.